I passionately believe in the rights of all Olympians to take part in fair competition.
A major shift at the very top of global sport. A rule change that will reshape who gets to compete and who doesn't. And a decision that's already been called everything from a victory for fairness to a step backwards for science and human rights. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And last week, the International Olympic Committee announced that transgender women and some athletes with differences in sex development will be banned from competing in the female category at the 2028 Olympics and beyond. The IOC were clear. They say it's about fairness, safety and integrity. They say it's about protecting women's sport.
So it's absolutely clear that it would not be fair for biological males to compete in the female category. In addition, in some sports, it would simply not be safe.
But there's critics who say the science on this isn't settled, that the policy isn't proportionate, and that the human cost of all of this could be significant.
It causes a harm, bodily, I'll say. And obviously, if you say the science, because we talk about science here, if the science is clear, show us who decided.
So how did we get to this point and what happens next? Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Blair Hamilton, Research Associate at Manchester Metropolitan University's Institute of Sport and a former women's footballer directly affected by similar rules which were introduced by the FA in the UK last year. Blair, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Thank you for having me.
Blair, just to get started, I suppose, what was your immediate reaction when you saw that the IOC had made that decision last week?
Yeah, my first reactions were that the new rules are already outdated and they're going to do some real harm come Los Angeles in 2028. I mean, they are trying to reduce a person's entire biology to a single SRY gene, which simply isn't how sex works or how it links with athletic performance. And the idea that this protects fairness in women's sport isn't backed by any science, and it really needs to be questioned.
I mean, given what Kirsty Coventry, who is the president of the IOC, said when she came in there, that she was going to protect women's sport, that was going to be one of her priorities, were you in any way surprised by this decision?
I was not surprised at this decision. Obviously, we kind of knew the changing landscape and we feared this was coming, but we're surprised it was coming.
I mean, last May, the FA introduced a similar ban on football in the UK. We thought it affected maybe 20 to 30 people. You were one of those individuals. What was that like, Blair? How did that actually feel?
And the FA's decision was quite interesting because it's another one that shows you it wasn't based on any scientific data. What little known fact about the FA's ruling was actually on the 11th of April, a month before the ban came in, the FA had actually updated their policy to say that it was okay for transgender women to keep playing football. And obviously with the new developments of the Supreme Court ruling in the UK, obviously defining what a woman was, a month later, the policy was shifted to a ban, obviously for politics rather than science. And obviously that was quite tough because obviously my athletic career had been cut short by at least 5 to 6 years. So obviously for any athlete, that's hard to take. But it certainly had a massive personal impact. One of the things I have to remember, you know, and I think a lot of people don't realise about this topic is there are humans at the end of it. My background, you know, I am trans. I was a trans athlete. You know, I research transgender people in sport and for their health. So the only chance I ever got a break from that was whenever I was trying to catch a ball on a Sunday and not having to think about all that. It really, for me especially, took away, you know, a coping mechanism, you know, an access to a sort of sporting family. So yeah, had a significant effect on my mental health and also my metabolic health, because obviously a barrier being access to sport, obviously, you know, movement is medicine and health is wealth. So you know, not being able to access sport certainly has not helped my figure, let's say that.
Given this conversation and how polarising it has been over the last number of decades, that people do sometimes forget there's athletes behind all of this, there are human beings affected?
Absolutely, yes. There's been several experiences where you look at the likes of Leah Thomas in the USA, you know, Laurel Hubbard in the Olympics, a lot of people, and especially myself online and in the UK as well, a lot of people, you know, go really hard on the athlete, especially when they were competing. But really, they should have went hard on the governing body. Aman Khalif in the Olympics, another one. Again, no one knows what Aman's condition is or if she even has a condition. Everyone hard on the athlete. If you're really not happy, like with the ruling, go after the governing body, and you know, remember there is a human at the end of this, because obviously it's tough for any human being to see themselves being talked in the media with such hostility.
You said that the science here is questionable, but it was interesting listening to Chrissy Coventry when she spoke about this decision. She spoke for about 2 minutes and she said repeatedly that this was about fairness. She said this was about safety. And she said the science here now is there. It is overwhelming. We have looked to scientific research to make this decision.
The policy that we have announced is based on science, and it has been led by medical experts with the best interests of athletes at its heart. The scientific evidence is very clear. Male chromosomes give performance advantages in sports that rely on strength, power, or endurance.
And there are plenty of people I know, including yourself, who directly challenge this decision and who say the science is there. The IOC would completely disagree with you on that.
They absolutely will. I actually, when I heard that from Kirsten Coventry's mouth, it did make me chuckle a little bit, because there is no good evidence that, you know, women athletes with sex variations or transgender female athletes have any real performance advantages or disadvantages. The data that we have at the moment is so inconsistent, it's so inconclusive, and a lot of it is methodologically flawed. And we really can't conclude anything from the literature pool in both cases. For example, if you look at, in case of transgender women athletes, there have only been about 34 transgender women athletes studied in a scientific fashion. And if we went in and did any sort of treatment for drugs or anything like that to find out how that affected it, we would never, ever, ever conclude anything in such a small sample size. Even worse, with the athletes with sex variations case, there's only been 2 studies done on that. And that was, you know, they were very methodologically flawed. There's been a lot of backlash against those 2 studies. So when you have such a, you know, a base of science that is so methodologically flawed and inconsistent and inconclusive, you can't conclude anything.
I mean, I'm very conscious here, Blair, that I'm not a scientist. I haven't read all of the scientific research on this to challenge what you're saying. But surely we have to go with the International Olympic Committee and believe that they have looked at the science here to come to this conclusion. They, I think, did acknowledge that there is very little high-quality data, but they say out of the data that is there that there is clear evidence that males have 10 to 12% performance advantage in endurance events, like in running and swimming. They have a 20% advantage in strength and power events, like jumping and throwing. They have even larger gaps, they say, in explosive or contact sports. And they say that there basically are advantages that are there from puberty that cannot be reversed, that will allow you to have greater muscle mass and strength, higher bone density and size, larger heart and lung capacity, and that they have argued that these traits are not fully reversed even after testosterone suppression.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting argument, because again, that comes from the fact is they are trying to take the differences between a cisgender woman athlete and a cisgender male athlete. You know, for example, as you said, the difference between running pace or whatever is 10%. But what they are doing with that, again, which is methodologically flawed, is that they are equating a transgender woman athlete to a cisgender male athlete. Now, as someone who's worked with transgender athletes for the past 6 years, I can tell you for a number one fact that these transgender female athletes are not equivalent to cisgender male athletes in the slightest. And that's before hormone therapy as well. Because what we found is before hormone therapy, they generally have lower muscle mass. They generally have lower bone health as well. They generally have lower lung capacity. They may have not lower lung size, but they have lower lung capacity and the ability to use it. If you're really comparing apples to apples here, you really need to compare transgender athletes and compare where they are to cisgender male athletes and cisgender female athletes. And that's sort of the work that I'm trying to continue to do today.
So if you say then the science isn't there, what do you think is driving this?
I think obviously politics is a big thing. We've seen a big change in politics in the past couple of years. Obviously with the rise of obviously Trump and also the Supreme Court ruling in the UK. The FA example was a big example of they actually looked at the policy and read all the evidence was there and said, actually, there's no reason to ban, so we'll just continue. And obviously the politics changed that view. I haven't seen the working group that made up this policy. And one of the things I have to question about the working group is why it's been kept so secret. And why, you know, like some myself, Professor Alan Williams, all these sort of people who are in this game and high level, why are we not being invited to this working group to give our points of view?
You mentioned repeatedly that this is based on science, but as far as I can see, the studies or the research that you base the decision on have not been included or published. Are you going to do that? And if not, why not?
Thank you very much for the question. Extensive research has been done by many of the experts within the expert group, and from a perspective of the wide-ranging bibliography that is there, that does exist. Whether it will be published, it's not certainly published as part of the policy, but we do have that bibliography for which the experts have gone through and added to.
To me, it seems very much that it could be, I can't confirm it obviously because I wasn't part of the working group, that this was a policy that Kirsty wants to bring in place and the evidence was cherry-picked to make that policy. But I can confirm that because, again, I am not privy to the working group. If I was privy to the working group and actually the workings and the evidence that they used and it was transparent, I then could critically analyse it and then give you a better answer. And this is the thing where critical analysis of science is really, really important because, as I said, you need to have a balanced view of experts and actually get in the room and then come to some consensus to actually have the best policy out there. If you choose cherry pick scientists or the data that you want to get your own conclusion that you're looking for, then it's not a valid policy, in my opinion. So there's some sports governing bodies that have done this and actually done it really well and come out with a better conclusion than just full-on banning or that sort of thing. Let's all critique the evidence together and let's find the consensus of where we all meet in the middle. Because again, there's never going to be a place where, you know, everyone agrees on it, but there has to be a place where the best science, the best, you know, minds come together who are from both sides, give the best policy.
And you don't feel that's happened at the IOC, but I know they would completely dispute that, as would many other scientists. They say they're going to do this by introducing genetic testing, this one-off SRI gene test. Can you tell me about that?
The SRI gene is basically called the sex-determining region Y, and it's a critical gene located on the Y chromosome that acts as a sort of, you know, master switch for initiating male sex development in mammals. Now, what's really interesting about this is that it's been said that, you know, a simple cheek swab, a simple, you know, blood test is going to tell you whether the athletes have an advantage or not. But what's really interesting is Professor Andrew Sinclair, who actually discovered the SRY gene, he's actually turned around and said that using the SRY gene to establish biological sex is wrong because all it tells you is whether or not the gene is present, you know. It doesn't tell you whether the SRY gene is functioning. It doesn't tell you whether, you know, testes have been formed. It doesn't tell you whether testosterone is produced and, you know, whether the body can respond to the testosterone or not. And what's really interesting about this policy, which is really quite harmful as well, sex testing sort of exposes women and girls here to sort of, you know, privacy violations, public humiliation and abuse, you know, is coercive because, you know, if you are literally saying to a young girl, a young IOC youth athlete, that you cannot participate in your sport unless you take this test, that's coercion. If, for example, an athlete takes this test and fails this test, for example, at elite level, everyone knows the reasons why that athlete has failed that test, so therefore it's not private. So again, this full regime does not protect women and girls. It actually really subjects them to an awful lot of harm.
Although the IOC would say the athletes will be treated with dignity and respect through this process. I mean, they have been clear, look, this is just at an elite level. This is not to grassroots or community organisations. Does that distinction hold?
Yeah, and this is the thing where the IOC really and other international sports organisations depict that these eligibility rules are only impacting elite competition. And when in practice that is, you know, completely not the case, you know, it also impacts, you know, women and girls at the grassroots level. You know, mandatory, you know, genetic sex testing sort of establishes that the presence of women and girls' participation is conditional in that sport. and any athlete can be called upon to provide a proof of their sex, basically on their appearance, whether they're too manly, so obviously places their appearance. So what that does is create an unsafe climate in which any woman or girl who excels at sport or does not meet any stereotypical definition of femininity can be targeted by peers, parents, sports administrations, or even elected officials. And really, as you've probably seen, you know, most of these athletes with sex variation specifically are from the Global South. So really disproportionately affects them. And generally, you know, if you don't look like the stereotypical West Side or view of what a woman looks like, then you're up to be challenged at this at the grassroots level as well. So it really does create extreme harm for me.
And yet, News Talk listeners over the last few days since this announcement was made have overwhelmingly supported the IOC decision. They wanted to express support and solidarity with trans people. That was, I have to say, the conclusion of many of the messages. But they repeatedly said this decision makes sense. They felt that this decision did actually protect girls, did actually protect young women and women who want to participate in sport. The IOC spoke repeatedly about safety, safety, safety. This is putting the safety of the wider female population who are participating in sport first.
As I was saying, I think this is where the messaging of this has sort of gone wrong with this, because obviously the headlines have sort of been running with here that, you know, as a transgender women are being banned from the Olympics. I think really what this policy has actually been, you know, made to actually target is really those athletes with sex variations first and foremost. The ones, as I said, the Caster Semenyas and those that are sort of athletes with sex variations in sport.
Personally, for her as a leader, she's an African. I'm sure she understands, you know, how, you know, we as Africans be coming from as a Global South, and you cannot control, you know, genetics. For me personally, for her being a woman coming from Africa, knowing how, you know, African women or women in the Global South are affected by that, of course, it causes a harm.
Now, from my point of view, as I said, if you are looking at any sort of thing, as I said previously, you know, talk about safety, fairness, all these sort of things, the data is not there to conclude these things. And I mean this both ways of if there is a safety issue or if there's not a safety issue. There is absolutely no data there that can confirm or deny these things. So again, this is where good science is really needed going forward.
I mean, we have seen some organisations like Swim Ireland try to come up, I suppose, with solutions here that they feel will support everyone. They've said they will ban transgender women from competitive sports, but they will try and create inclusive training programmes, for example, or open competitions.
What we have to realise is that World Aquatics, which used to be FINA, they actually tried that approach. They tried the approach of, you know, let's have trans only category for, you know, swimmers to swim in, and funnily enough no one entered. And what's really interesting is we look back to the FA policy, as you said early on in this podcast, is there's only, I mean, a fleet of 23 24 transgender women in the full of England, and, you know, a population of, you know, how many million. How are we going to create a trans inclusive or trans only league, 11 aside, out of those 27 players who are based nationwide? Obviously, it's not a practical solution to the problem, I'm afraid.
Do you think when it comes to the Olympics going forward, Blair, the policy now is settled?
I do not think so. The policy, I can imagine, will be challenged in the Court of Arbitration of a Sport. And imagine there will be athletes that bring up challenges to this. Again, Kirsty Coventry even admitted this in our press conference. You know, any policy is, you know, subject to challenge. I would imagine that this would be, as I said, challenged at the highest level.
Blair Hamilton, Research Associate at Manchester Metropolitan University. Thanks so much for joining us here on News Talk Daily.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a conversation that isn't going away anytime soon, and it is one that does seem to raise difficult questions about fairness and about identity and about integrity and about inclusion. You can email us your own thoughts to newstalkdaily@newstalk.com. We'd love to hear from you, or get me on Instagram @officialKiraD. I'm Ciara Doherty. This has been News Talk Daily. I'll be back with another podcast bright and early tomorrow.